This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to our last talk for this session on the sixth day of Rohatsu. And we're honored to have from Pennsylvania, from Owen Zendo, Mado. So welcome, Mado. It's been a while since you've been here, but it feels like home looking into your space there from here, nearly 3,000 miles away. I wish I had something I could just give you. But we'll work on that. We're working on quantum Zoom. So next time. So welcome.
Thank you so much, Doug. Typically, I would be sitting right there in the Zendo. It's been probably over 20 years of making this pilgrimage from Pennsylvania to Jikoji, also to see my daughter in Alameda, who I miss, and also all my spiritual family at Jikoji. And so I want to thank you for giving me the honor of presenting and offering this last talk, and to thank you and all the residents of Jikoji for making this possible. And it's not just a general thank you, it's very precise. This takes work, I know, because I'm here at Owen, a Dharma center that also needs upkeep and needs tender loving care and needs all these, the cushions to be vacuumed and the meals to be made and the rocks to be moved and the tea bowls to be washed and moving things around, putting the schedule together, problem solving. This is all work that goes on to make it possible for us to come together in this open sharing space. So a very precise thank you for all the small and big things that you all do to welcome us. Thank you. And it's wonderful to see familiar faces and a number of unfamiliar faces. Usually when I'm on Zoom these days, my Sangha is up there and I know everyone, and it's kind of easy, but it's very nice to make new friends and to hear from those of you who practice in California. When I was reciting this sutra with you, and also reading along with it, I found myself swaying back and forth, especially when I was listening with my eyes closed sometimes and just listening to the reading. I found myself swaying. And I found this sutra very evocative. It evoked many memories for me. And one of these memories, this muscle memory of swaying back and forth, renewed an experience I had as a young child who would yearly visit my grandparents who lived in the Lower East Side of New York in a tenement. They were newly coming from Russia. And in the basement of the tenement was what we called a shul. It was really a synagogue. It was a little temple in the basement of this tenement. It was a tiny room. And I remember sneaking up down from my grandmother's little apartment. This was during Passover. And she would have a carp, a fish, in her bathtub, ready to be actually slaughtered and made into what we called gefilte fish, which was part of our Passover meal. But I would sneak down to this mystical place in the basement of this tenement where all the men were praying. And I would, of course, women weren't allowed in there. And so I would just kind of stay on the staircase and watch them swaying back and forth with their yarmulkes and their prayer shawls. It was dark and there were just candles and the Torah was illuminated, but not very much else was illuminated except those beautiful white prayer shawls and their white caps and the sound of this mystical Hebrew language. And it was called davening. And I always thought that davening was this act of swaying back and forth. But I actually looked it up before I gave this talk. And davening means praying. This back and forth is called shuckling, which is a kind of an interesting, funny word. And so as I was listening to this sutra and also reciting it, I had this incredibly strong impulse to shuckle, to sway back and forth. It felt like praying to me. It felt like I was finally admitted to the shul, that I could enter this mystical place that my grandfather was able to enter, but I wasn't. But I did have my grandfather with me while we were reciting the sutra. And I was recalling one of the questions that was asked. And one of the questions was, why do we have to study sutras if our practice is beyond words and scripture? It's kind of the same question in a different way that Dogen asked when he asked, why do we have to practice since we're already enlightened? But it was important for me to have my grandfather with me during this session. And the answer that was coming up for me in why we recite these sutras and why we study these sutras is so that we can have our ancestors with us. If not them, not us. Because of them, us. And so it's really important to welcome them, back in every time we sit, every time we have Sesshin, to invite them back to sit with us. And we can do that in part by studying the sutras, by listening to their names, by repeating their words. And in repeating their words, the words become scripture. And only then can we go beyond scripture. When we say our practice is beyond words of scripture, I'm not sure that it means that it's without words in scripture. But that it goes through words in scripture to another place. And when that happens, words become sacred. They become prayer. Just as, you know, this flower garland sutra, some of you may be aware of Eckhart Tolle's book, A New Earth, which he introduces with a kind of homage to flowers, because flowers appeared in the course of evolution as a kind of, it's one of those appearances that didn't have any real practical value. Flowers, you know, they're sort of the sacred expression of vegetation. And so the Flower Garland Sutra is a kind of sacralization, making sacred of words. They're sacred words. And they're evocative. They're not designed to be intellectually understood, but to be as a prayer. And sometimes it feels like when we recite these words, we're speaking in tongues. There came a point in the recitation of the sutra when I kind of lost all sense of the conventional meaning of words, and the words, it felt like I was just speaking in tongues. The words went beyond anything that was intellectually discernible. I learned a while ago that in the Zulu community, the Bushmen in South Africa, they have a way of greeting one another, which is quite extraordinary. When one appears to another, he or she says, "Sawkona," which means, "We are here." And the other person says, "Sawubona," which means, "We see you." This is the greeting. It's not, "Hi, how are you?" or shaking of hands. It's, "I'm here. I'm here to be seen." And the other person says, "We see you." It's a way of bringing into presence human beings, realizing their presence together. And notice that they don't use the word I. It's we are here. And we see you. So it's a, they have a very deep sense of ancestral community. And so when they think of themselves as coming with their entire ancestry, so we are here. We're all here, the whole Sangha. The whole history of our people. I am here only because of all of them. And the other person doesn't say, I see you. It's, we see you. I come also with this entire community. So this is the sense, the feeling that I have when we come together in Sesshin or in our practice. We don't come alone. I come with my grandfather, who I haven't really made a connection with for a very long time. And realized how he's with me as I pray, and as I was not able to be with him so many years ago. This capacity to be in community this way brings me joy. To be with him, to be with you, to be with my Sangha, to be with all beings is a glimpse of joy. And to me, that's in a way what this sutra is all about. It's about sukha, much more than about dukkha. And the language of the sutra, the imagery of the sutra, the richness of the sutra, the light and the sounds, it's all, it's like that little shul in the basement, full of candlelight and human bodies swaying together, the scriptures lit up, embedded in the tenement, embedded in the home where my grandparents lived. It was their life. What joy to be able to pray in this way at home. So we get a glimpse of what it might feel like and look like to be liberated, to experience that joyfulness. It's almost like, you know, when you when you have a fever for a while, or you're sick, and then the fever breaks. I know I have this experience. And then there's a kind of euphoria that sets in. It's like, whoa. I just feel so incredibly energized, and I feel like I can go and conquer the world. I've healed that moment when you know you're better. It's like that with our practice often. It's like, oh, I have a glimpse of this incredible liberation from this fever, these delusions, these illusions, this suffering. My fever has broken for a moment. And this beautiful light has shone through. And I know that it's possible. Because our practice is much more about sukha, liberation, than it is about suffering. It's the way of liberation. And so one of the joys of the bodhisattva is to introduce all beings to the joy of being free. And it's the joy of the bodhisattva, as it's enumerated in this sutra, to discover all the myriad ways of helping beings get a glimpse of this. It takes deep attention to beings to get a sense of how to give them a glimpse of this in ways that they can access it. So that's the joyful work of the bodhisattva, to pay attention. So this term, enlightening beings, it can be seen on the one hand as an enlightening, as an adjective. That is, this bodhisattva, all of the voices that we heard, all the bodhisattva voices in this sutra, are enlightening beings. They are in the process of being enlightened. They are enlightening. It's not a final state. It's not an enlightened being. It's not a finalized being. It's an enlightening being, a being who is in process. But it's also not just an adjective describing the bodhisattva, but it's a verb. These are beings who are enlightening others. They are shining lights so others can get a glimpse of the joy of this practice. It's kind of like walking in the darkness and having a flashlight. And I have this image of walking up to the ridge at Jokoji at night. And somebody, maybe Hogan, is holding a flashlight, or maybe it's Doug, and showing the way just a few steps ahead of us. these enlightening beings are showing us the way, are lighting up the way for us. And I'm reminded of many times, and maybe this evokes some of the times that you've gotten glimpses of this sacred world. There was a time when I was in Sesshin, and it was a Rinzai temple, and we were actually eating a meal, our evening meal, at a table, and we all had bowls of miso soup, and the miso was dark miso, and above the table was a beautiful Japanese lantern. And I was picking my bowl of miso soup up to drink from it. And the miso was just as calm and even as possible. And there was the lantern in my soup. And I thought, it was so real. It's there. There's a lantern in my soup. And of course, it was reminding me of how the moon shines in the pond without disturbing the water. And times when I remember a time when I was standing outside of the Zendo here at Owon, and there was a steady rain coming off the roof. I was standing on the deck, and I was watching the rain come off the roof, and just the way the light was, it was like an endless flow of Christmas tinsel, just flowing off the roof. And I was, as Mary Oliver said, what she wanted on her tombstone, she said, I wanted to read, she was a bride married to amazement. She was a bride married to amazement. Just joyful at that sight. The first time at Chikoji, my wonderful tea teacher, Juro, made us tea very early in the morning, and walking into the Zendo and seeing the smoke on a very cold morning, the smoke from the kama rising into the air. And thus, those of us walking in to be offered this simple bowl of tea. And it was magical. It was deeply moving. These are all glimpses of how our practice shines a light on our world and sacralizes everything, makes everything sacred. It's like, you know, the Roksu or the Buddha's Okesa, made out of all discarded materials. Menstrual cloth that is comes from funeral pyres, discarded garbage, all of it sewn together to make a sacred garment. It's sacralizing the world as flowers are sacred expressions of vegetation, as our scriptures are sacralized words. They help us glimpse the joy of our practice. So I was considering two other teachers that I've had, very kind of distant teachers. One was Darwin, who had a glimpse of the sacred character of the world. And I'd like to just read you something that quite astounded me in the last paragraphs, the last chapter of Origin of the Species. It is no accident that we find ourselves perched on one tiny twig in the midst of a blossoming and flowering tree of life. No accident that we are surrounded by millions of other species, eating, growing, rotting, swimming, walking, flying, burrowing, stalking, chasing, fleeing, outpacing, outwitting. I want to daven while I'm reading this. This is Darwin. We are surrounded by endless forms, more beautiful and most wonderful. And it is no accident, but the direct consequence of evolution, the greatest show on earth. There is grandeur in this view of life, with its several powers having been originally breathed into a few forms or one. And while this planet has gone cycling on according to the fixed law of gravity, from so simple a beginning, endless forms, most beautiful and most wonderful, have been and are being evolved. Darwin. Darwin was sitting by a swamp when he wrote these words, watching, having a glimpse of the beauty of the world, of the sacredness of the world, and helping us, he's a bodhisattva, helping us see that light. He is enlightening beings. He's helping us see and glimpse the joy. And the other teacher that I want to mention is Plato. And Plato, in his dialogue, this symposium, is his dialogue on love. And Socrates, who is always the main person in the dialogues, insists that the speakers at the dialogue, each one of them has a turn in speaking about love, that they don't begin their speeches until everyone gets drunk. It's almost like we don't really begin to practice until the sesshin is over. It's only when we're really completely exhausted and the shine of our ego has completely been destroyed that practice can begin. So Socrates says, you know, we all have to be drunk in order to talk about love. Why? Because you can't talk about love when you're too sober and too rational. So you sort of have to get out of your mind to talk about love. And one of the ways of doing that, if you're drunk, you may be able to speak from the heart. You may be able to say something noble, something that wouldn't come from the discursive mind. And so there is, for me, a sense of being totally intoxicated by this sutra. It's intoxicating. I'm drunk with the Dharma. I don't know whether Jiro is here, but I remember early on in our discussions, Jiro already said that he was stuffed. We had read enough so that he had already had it up to here. And my sense was that I think Jiro was suggesting that beyond that, we would get drunk. But we had to go beyond that. We had to go beyond being stuffed. Just getting intoxicated. And like my grandfather, just praying. Just the joy of prayer. So maybe I'd like to kind of, an image is coming up now for me. Maybe this will be a good image to end with and then invite you into the conversation. The image that's coming to me is the image of, you know, on these posters of the earth, and then there's an arrow saying, you are here, right? To give us a sense of how tiny we are, right? You are here. But this sutra and our practice is the other end of the arrow. You are here. This is what our scriptures and our recitations and our practice bring us to. This place on the earth is not the only place we are. Where is the arrow coming from? I remember Pamela's question about who. But this is who too. Where's the arrow coming from? Right? It's all of it. And we can help each other enter this realm of sukha, of joy, together. And so, deep gratitude. I never would have confession. I never would have gone so deeply into this sutra on my own. And thus, without you, I would never have entered that shul with my grandfather. Women not allowed. So thank you all. So now it's your turn.
Thank you, Mido, for the talk. It's really beautiful. Particularly, I like when you talked about Sesshin and sitting in a Sesshin destroys the shine of the ego. Can you talk more about that? I'd like to learn more on that. Thank you.
I'd kind of be happy to, but I have talked enough and I'm happy to go back to that. But I think every one of us has probably experienced that, and maybe it would be fun, helpful to hear what you, others, have experienced as the disappearing of the shine of the ego.
I mean, for me, it is like sitting with pain, mostly like this session, right, or even months before. It's like being able to sit with pain. That's the experience. I'll let others talk.
So we come to Sesshin the first day. You know, we come from our various lives and we are shaved and our hair looks decent and, you know, we're presentable. And as the days go by, the bags begin to show under our eyes and our hair is messed up and we don't walk with as great a spring to our step. And maybe our shoulders are hunched over and we smell a little bit because we haven't showered. Or, you know, I mean, we're tired. And it's almost like Plato or Socrates insisting that everyone get drunk, or sometimes at the end of a party when everybody is exhausted and everybody's danced their heart out, then things get interesting. Because you kind of, you're so tired, you're not too much in control. which the ego likes to be. The ego likes to be in control.
By the way, Mado, when is your next party and where is it going to be?
Come on down. I think Doug peered in one time when we were having this great party in the Zendo, right, Doug? I think it was Chris Colin and I forget who else, someone from South America. We were dancing for hours on end. So it can happen at Jikoji. I recommend it, Taizan. Yeah, so what I'm suggesting is that here we are at the end of Sesshin, and I bet everybody's feeling not as much put together, being presentable in the typical way that we present ourselves in the world. But we're kind of worn out. We've worn out all of our narratives and all of our presentations of ourselves, hopefully. I mean, that would be wonderful if that were the case. It seems to me that's what happens to me. And when I look around at others who have practiced for 7 days, particularly during Rohatsu, everybody looks kind of reduced to just being human. Just being a living, breathing being without many pretensions. I hope that. Yes.
When, in one of the earlier days of Sesshin, oh, I'm sorry, Carolyn, do you want to speak?
Oh, no, I'm sorry, Tom. Go ahead. You were speaking first, so please.
I found myself during Zazen sort of rehearsing things I wanted to say on Zoom, you know, later, rehearsing things I could have said in the previous session that would have been a lot smarter than what I did say. And I thought of this book title from, I think, a psychology class I took in college, you know, 50 years ago or more, The Presentation of Self in Everyday Life. Do you know that one? I think the guy's name is Goffman because I looked it up. And it's like the theory is that we all are like actors. It's like life as theater, and you present yourself on a stage, and you show how you want to. You have an idea of how you want to present yourself, but then there's a backstage personality where you can more or less be yourself. And I'm not sure if that's all, but anyway. I don't know what my point is. I guess I'd aspire to not be an actor and just be the backstage guy, you know, that I suppose maybe, or self. I guess we don't necessarily believe in self, do we? So anyway, that's what I thought of when Mahesh, you know, asked that question about ego. Thank you.
Well, I wanted to say something about when Mahesh brought in a very specific circumstance that he connected somehow with the ego, or I felt, about pain and being with pain. And I'm reminded what has helped me a lot, and I have sat with a lot of pain in different times. And I'm referring to what Chuck brought in. We both each mentioned the Satipatthana Sutta, which And also this arising and seeing when you pay really careful attention to the actual physical sensation of pain, seeing its changes and its impermanence. So I have found that very useful in, and just that, just so you are paying attention, but in the way of mindfulness and awareness. And that act of paying attention, truly, it's your own pain, but there's a way in which the not self arises and the ego disappears. And it does take, it takes sticking with it. I remember practicing in early days in Vipassana and insight groups, and someone who had been around longer than I had at that time, he said, "There's nothing like knee pain to bring you right to the present." And looking into that impermanence. So
on Monday, Mike spoke about how, I think he said this on Monday, and Mike, I hope you're there and listening at Michael's iPad, that pain is not ours. I mean, when you feel this pain, you can, it sure feels like it's mine, but it isn't. How can you, and so Michael, are you there? Can you speak to that point? I think that's an important one. I guess maybe he's not there. So the accumulate, can pain accumulate? Can you take it with you? Can we take all our pain with us when we die? It just, it evaporates, it dissipates. And so maybe it's that, the conundrum of like, I got to get out of this situation because it hurts. And by recognizing that it is only one of the myriad sensations that we experience, then even in the midst of the pain, if it's not ours, then other things that are not ours that we hear, like the birds and the laughing squirrels here in this valley, or the cars roaring by, are just also of equal. And when we hold on to the pain as if it's ours, I feel a lot of pain, I'm really hurting bad, this is really the most miserable thing, or whatever, you know, it's just all about me. And if we can see that it is just itself pain, like everything else, then we can sit with it, which is going to be helpful when we die. Last week, Hogan and I sat with our dear friend Robert, who at 90 passed away and was in some pain, but he did not take any medications. He did not, he just stayed with it, and he had loving people around him. He was one of the really, really, really fortunate ones to have loving people around. There are so many people who die alone, but he just was with it, whatever pain there is in that process. And so as we rest in this body, of sensation, we don't give it a high, any sensation, any special value, except those that we really like.
Anyway. So I feel like it's my duty tonight to continue to introduce joy. this is incredibly interesting to see how the tendency that we have is always to gravitate towards suffering, which is, of course, a deep element in our practice. But in this particular case, and again, responding to Mahesh and what all of you have been saying, when you sit long enough, and particularly during Sesshin, when that sitting is relentless, you have a fighting chance of experiencing the space between your pain and something we call ourself. You have a fighting chance of experiencing what you're talking about, Doug, or Michael mentioned, that this isn't my pain. You've got to sit long enough to, it's almost a muscular thing that you get this space between you and all this stuff that is attaching to you. And that space, when you can dwell in that space, that is joy. That is liberation. That's just my take on it. So I don't want us to get stuck totally in suffering tonight. It's just, I've been invited, so I'm going to insist upon bringing us back to the joy in our practice that can be accessed through pain, but we got to practice.
I wanted to say thank you for reminding us about the joy, and that I don't find it very separable from the suffering. I think they would go together. I've noticed in this time of separation from Chikoji and from loved ones and friends and family, you know, that I've found the suffering has really illuminated the affection and illuminated what's important. And that's very joyful. I also wanted to thank you for bringing in your ancestors. Those are my ancestors too, Mado. My grandfather, both sides, grandparents were from Russia. I know those movements. I know those rooms and those lights and those songs. And so I enjoyed visiting with them while you were speaking. And I really appreciate your paying attention to, I usually shy away from this word, but it feels the right word right now, which is the holiness of this gathering, just this right now, this gathering. It feels, I guess you would say sacred, I would say holy. Tonight, it feels very holy. And I think I appreciate your pointing how paying attention reminds us how holy everything is, that it's just a big beam of awareness about how lucky we are in every moment, no matter how unfortunate we are, you know, how holy it is just to be here and tonight to be together. So thanks for reminding us.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jikoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge. and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jikoji, please visit us on the web at jikoji.org.